Chapter 17. Stoker brewed us a strong pot of tea whilst we considered the implications of the sketch. I retrieved a stack of newspapers from the Germanic section of the Belvedere and pointed him to the relevant dates whilst I took over the chore of making the tea. His German was rough, but much better than mine, and with the assistance of a German-English dictionary, not quite as good as an Alpenwalder English dictionary, but such a volume has yet to be written, he managed to decipher the broad strokes of the Hochstadt court circular for the dates in question. By the time the last of the tea had been drunk, and the better part of an entire tin of Cook's candied ginger shortbread consumed, he was finished.
"I have compared the dates of Gisela's absences from the Alpenwald to Alice's expeditions when she climbed with D. You are correct. They tally in every particular."
"That is why she was making her home in the Alpenwald," I said, still not entirely believing how blind we had been to the possibility of Alice's affections being fixed upon Gisela. "How devastated she must have been," I added.
"What do you mean?"
Stoker's brow furrowed. They clearly spent much time together, cared deeply for one another. Gisela must have been distraught when Alice died, and yet, as princess, she could never publicly reveal her grief. Imagine her, forced to conceal her emotions all this time. I fell silent as a growing horror dawned swiftly upon me. Stoker was quick to intuit my thoughts.
"And then we told her that the woman she loved was murdered. Worst of all, she overheard it. It was not put to her gently or kindly. It was a passing piece of gossip, and we discussed it as if it were an academic matter, rather than a tragedy of the most intimate variety."
And then a new horror introduced itself, a crawling, wriggling, nasty little doubt. "Unless..." I let my voice trail off uncertainly.
"Unless?"
he prompted. "Unless Gisela is the one who murdered her," I finished grimly.
"You cannot be serious,"
Stoker said, in a tone which did not invite argument. But I would not be deterred. "We are investigating this matter. As logical thinkers, we cannot ignore the possibility of Gisela's guilt." He folded his arms over the breadth of his chest.
"I am listening. Lay out the argument."
"Very well. Most murders are committed within the confines of a domestic relationship. For all its unorthodoxy, this attachment falls within that frame. In fact, I would argue that it does so even more than a conventional relationship."
"How so?"
"Those whose love is not sanctioned by society are forced to hide their affections. Such a situation can draw people closer together, heightening both passions and tensions. There may be no one in whom they can confide if there are troubles, no one who might advise or give them wise counsel on how to manage such a situation. It is easy then for matters to simply move beyond their control."
"Are you speaking from personal experience?"
he asked, one corner of his mouth quirking up. "Some might say I am engaging in such an experience now," I returned tartly. "Our liaison is not sanctioned by society. Neither the law nor the church will give us a veneer of respectability. If we were to find ourselves frustrated by one another, there are precious few to whom either of us might turn for succour."
"Are you?"
"Am I what?"
"Frustrated with me."
"At the moment, yes, wildly so. We are speaking of a murder investigation, and you have turned the tables to make this conversation about us." He seemed about to offer a rejoinder, then shrugged instead.
"All right, carry on."
I resumed the thread of my argument. Without the possibility of loving openly, Gisela and Alice would be forced to conduct their affair in secret, stealing time together. I gestured towards the list of dates and scribbled names of villages. A handful of expeditions together, no doubt with Gisela incognita, and each time she leaves the Alpenwald, she must... I foundered. She must what? How did she leave? I know they said she slipped away from her royal duties, but she is the head of state. She has guards, ladies in waiting. Someone must have helped her. Someone must have known about Alice.
Not necessarily.
Stoker crossed one booted ankle over the other.
She might have made some sort of excuse, taking the waters at a spa town or needing a rest. She might have pleaded ill health or nerves, neither of which the Alpenwalder court would want to publicize. It is always bad for business when a head of state is in ill health, a holdover from the medieval belief that the body of the king was connected to the welfare of the country itself. Healthy king, healthy land.
And you think the Alpenwalders would have been content to let their princess fob them off with such stories?
It is one possibility. They are her subjects, Veronica. They would not pry too deeply, even if they suspected she was off on an assignation. And if they did suspect it, they would never tell us,
he pointed out.
Every one of the Alpenwalders we have spoken to has been evasive on the subject of Gisela's absences. Whatever story she spun them, they trust that she can manage her own affairs and will always return. Except that this time she has not. She left, no doubt of her own accord, after learning that Alice was most likely murdered. Perhaps she simply needed time to come to terms with the possibility.
Or she realized she was about to be unmasked as a murderess, I said. He rolled his eyes heavenwards.
And what was her motive to kill the woman she loved?
Exposure, I told him quickly. If Alice decided to reveal the affair, it would be catastrophic for Gisela. People are intolerant enough of sapphic practices amongst private citizens. What would the conservative Alpenwalders have to say about their princess loving another woman? It could spark a revolution.
And why would Alice do that?
I spread my hands. A quarrel, perhaps? People do strike out against the ones they love when they are disappointed and hurt. What if Alice threatened her in a moment of anger? Gisela would have been frightened out of her wits.
You almost sound sorry for her,
Stoker said coldly. Pity and empathy are not the same, I replied. I can understand her actions if that is what happened. She would have been terrified of the affair coming to light, the scandal it would have caused. So she could have determined that Alice would have to die.
Why not simply send her away with a sum of money?
Stoker suggested. Alice would never be bought, I told him. She had a peculiar sort of integrity. No, she would never have taken a penny of Gisela's money if the princess tried to purchase her silence. Stoker thought a moment.
There are two rather gaping holes in the fabric of your theory. First, Gisela was not in the Alpenwald when Alice died. I seem to remember you saying she was abroad at the time. And second, the only one seen on the mountain that day was a mustachioed man. So even if you are about to suggest that Gisela made a pretense of leaving and came back, she does not fit the description of the possible murderer.
I gave him a withering stare. She was disguised, of course.
As a man with moustaches,
he finished, in a voice dripping with scorn.
It sounds like a penny dreadful, Veronica. I refuse to believe that Her Serene Highness, the hereditary princess of the Alpenwald, pasted on false moustaches and climbed a mountain to murder her lover.
She would not have to, I said slowly. She would not have to be there at all. The princess could have had an accomplice, and who better than the man who intends to marry her, Duke Maximilian of Lokendorf, I finished in triumph. Stoker stared at me a long moment.
Bloody bollocks, he muttered.
My smile was one of purely feline satisfaction. It is a very good theory, I told him.
It is not the worst you might have fashioned,
he said with a grudging nod.
It does at least tick every box.
Indeed it does, I said, smoothing my skirts. Now we have only to find proof.
Proof? How in the name of Seven Hells do you intend to do that?
We must gain access to the Alpenwalder suite, I told him.
Absolutely out of the question,
he replied. I blinked at him. Why ever not?
Why ever not? Let me enumerate the reasons,
he said, holding up each finger in turn.
First, a possibly homicidal princess who has gone missing. Second, her possible accomplice, a potentially murderous aristocrat who is a little too free with his admiration of your person. Third, courtiers who may or may not have knowledge of the princess's liaison with a murder victim and who could have easily conspired with her to commit the crime. Did it never occur to you, Veronica, that they might all have done it? What if they plotted together, all of those bloody Alpenwalders, to remove Alice from the scene? The Chancellor and the Baroness would do anything for Gisela. They adore her. And Durand is captain of her guard. I do not know if he would draw the line at murder, but there is every chance he would not. And Yelena's entire world is bound up in her employer. There is not one member of that retinue that would balk at killing for her or covering it up if she ordered someone killed. Of this, I have absolutely no doubt.
As he finished his impassioned speech, a lock of long black hair fell over his brow. His nostrils were flaring like a stag's, and I realized we had taken positions in opposition to one another, squared off like combatants, our hands curled into fists. You are, of course, correct, I told him. My humble reply caught him off guard, and he dropped his arms, unclenching his fists.
I am?
Naturally, I said, in the same soothing tone. But I am afraid your opposition, while well considered, is not enough to keep us from continuing this investigation.
What makes you say that?
He demanded. Because George has just come in behind you, and from the envelope in his hand, I believe we have been summoned once more to the Sudbury. Chapter 18. Stoker sulked all the way to the hotel, whilst I tried very hard not to gloat, and failed.
Smugness does not become you, Veronica,
he told me in icy tones as we alighted at the curb. I said nothing. I merely favoured him with my most dazzling smile and swept inside the hotel, careful to keep my veiled face averted from any of the reporters or detectives who were no doubt loitering in the lobby. The Alpenwalders received us warmly. The Baroness answered the door herself, and as we moved into the drawing room of the suite, I could see the Chancellor sitting behind the desk, but of Duke Maximilian there was no sign.
Thank you so much for coming,
the Baroness said in a fervent tone as she pressed my hands. Your note only asked us to call, I told her. Have there been any developments? Has the princess returned?
Not yet,
she replied, her mouth set in a serious line.
But I know she will come soon. She must.
The Chancellor rose from the desk, gesturing towards a stack of newspapers.
There have been many reports about the bomb, naturally,
he told us.
And we had a call very early this morning from an Inspector Mornaday.
At the mention of Mornaday's name, my heart skipped an uncomfortable beat. I exchanged a quick glance with Stoker.
Oh?
He came to tell us that it was as Mr. Templeton Vane surmised. The bomb was no bomb at all, really only a glorified firecracker,
he said.
He wished to pay his respects and apologize personally to the princess, but the Baroness and I were able to prevent this by saying Her Serene Highness was in need of rest after the upset of last evening. We also made a statement cancelling all official engagements today, which will work quite well, I think, since we are still without a princess,
he added with a moo of regret. He turned to me.
You have done well, Fräulein. So well, in fact, that I am afraid I must prevail upon you once more.
Beside me, I felt Stoker stiffen like a pointer.
I think Miss Speedwell has accommodated your schemes quite enough,
Stoker began. The Chancellor held up a hand.
Please,
he said, nearly choking on the word. So startled were we by his pleading that we fell silent and let him continue. He did so with obvious difficulty, speaking slowly, as if extracting each word cost him pain.
How much do you know of the situation on the continent?
He asked, but it was apparent the question was rhetorical, as he launched into a discussion that echoed the one I had enjoyed with the Baroness on our first meeting.
If I told you it was a powder keg, it would not be an exaggeration. Matters are so delicate that all it wants is the slightest spark and...
He spread his fingers upwards, making the gesture of an explosion.
Loyalties are so conflicted and convoluted that if Germany went to war, it would plunge the rest of Europe into chaos.
He paused and went to rummage in a folio of papers, extracting a large map of the continent.
Look here,
he urged, pointing towards the middle of the map.
The German Empire is coloured in blue. You see the change from only a few decades ago?
He laid another map beside it.
With the unification of the German states, the Empire has become powerful. Too powerful,
he added under his breath. I surveyed the maps. The earlier one looked like a broken plate, colourful bits strewn across the breadth of Europe, each representing a different tiny German-speaking principality or duchy. The current one was a single, terrifying monolith, collected under one banner and ruled by the Hohenzollerns from Berlin.
This was the work of Bismarck, he said, but he is a fool. He argued that knitting the German states together under the rule of the Empire would make them more powerful. But the only one who has gained from it is the Emperor himself.
Kaiser Wilhelm, I finished.
The second of that name,
the Chancellor said with a grave nod.
Those of us outside of the Empire had hopes for his father, a great and progressive man. When he ascended to the throne last spring, we believed it was a new beginning for all of us. We did not realize he was doomed.
He added, crossing himself. I had been in Madeira at the time, but I vaguely remembered reading about the 3-month reign of Kaiser Frederick. He had been a gentle soul, progressive and forward-thinking, unlike his warlike and reactionary son. The Chancellor went on.
For 30 years, Kaiser Frederick bided his time, waiting for his turn to remake Germany, to bring her into the light with the help of his Empress.
His Empress was of special interest to me. She was the eldest child of our Queen, Victoria, and had been named for her august mother. As Princess Royal, she had been the apple of her father's eye, schooled by Prince Albert in the English principles of liberality and fairness. Throughout her long marriage to Frederick, she had remained steadfast in her beliefs, in spite of the damage this caused to her popularity with the Germans. They clung to the glory of their warlike past, and her eldest son, now the Kaiser, had followed in those traditions. The Empress was unpopular, I began, but the Chancellor made a noise of derision.
Unpopular. She was reviled, treated with the greatest of contempt by her own son. All those years, waiting to put her mark upon Germany, and her husband's reign lasts no more than 3 months. A single season for them to rule, and even that was thwarted. Everyone knew Kaiser Frederick was ill when he ascended. The court and the army looked beyond him, as if he were already a ghost. They did not even bother to bend a knee to his will. They did as his son bade them. And as soon as Wilhelm became emperor, they turned on Empress Frederick with all the savagery of which they are capable.
She was not mistreated?
Stoker asked in horror.
She was,
the Chancellor confirmed,
actually shoved about by her son's men. They came to her palace to remove her papers, her personal and private papers, because her son believed her a traitor to Germany. She, who did nothing but work for the peace of Europe.
He added bitterly. His colour was high, the dueling scars on his cheeks standing out white against his scarlet skin. He took a few deep breaths.
But they found nothing. She is as cautious as she is clever.
He added with a sly smile.
She sent her papers to England, and she thwarted her son. For all his cruelty, he is not intelligent. He could never anticipate how far she would go to secure peace in Europe.
How far would she go?
Stoker asked. The Chancellor paused, assessing us carefully.
I will tell you something that you must vow never to reveal outside of this room. I require your word of honor, both of you, on pain of death.
The words were startling, but his manner was grave. Stoker and I did not look at one another as we swore. The Chancellor reached into his portfolio and drew forth a document.
The Alpenwald is one of the few German-speaking states to resist Bismarck's aggression. She remains independent in spite of the danger.
The danger? I asked. He pointed to the map, sketching out a movement.
Should Germany decide to go to war, she will attack France first, The Alpenwald lies in the clearest and most direct route. We would be destroyed if we oppose the German Empire. But oppose her, we will.
He finished fiercely. He went to the desk and unlocked a drawer, drawing out a leather portfolio stamped with the crest of the Alpenwald.
This is a treaty between the Alpenwald and France. It is a binding pact of mutual defense against the German Empire.
Stoker gave a soundless whistle as we bent to read the text. It was in English and brief, bereft of the usual flowery diplomatic language that characterized such things. It was a promise to be signed by both governments, to protect one another and come to each other's aid in the event of German aggression.
How on earth did you manage to get the French to agree to this?
Stoker asked.
I did not,
the Chancellor told him.
It was the work of the Empress Frederick.
Our Princess Royal Victoria? I goggled at him. Our British princess has brokered a treaty against her own son's interests.
Because his interests are not those of good and peaceful men,
the Chancellor said sternly.
She has tried the whole of her life to instill in him the principles of democracy upon which she was weaned, but his upbringing was taken out of her hands by his grandfather. He was schooled to admire all things military and warlike, to love aggression and fighting and the glory of Germany.
His moustaches quivered in disgust.
He was never taught to cherish peace, to work for the good of his people. His mother is deeply afraid, you see. She has seen a change in him since he ascended the throne. For decades, Bismarck counted upon being able to control Wilhelm when he came to power. But the Chancellor grows old, and he cannot keep Wilhelm under his thumb. The Kaiser does as he pleases, and he sees himself as a new Frederick the Great, bestriding Europe and the rest of the world. He cares nothing for peace and freedom, and in the great battle, his mother will be on the side of the angels. She does what she can for the cause that is just, and we are grateful to her.
He finished with fervor. He took out a handkerchief and mopped his bald head, dabbing at his eyes. The subject was clearly an emotional one for him, and Stoker and I looked at the maps until he had regained control of himself. The Chancellor grasped my hands suddenly.
Miss Speedwell, I would not ask if it were not of the greatest importance, my dear, but the future of Europe depends upon thwarting the ambitions of the Kaiser. If we do not stand together, he will do everything in his power to set us against one another.
What do you need of me? I asked gently.
The treaty is to be signed tonight,
he began.
Miss Speedwell, you cannot conceive of what this treaty will mean for us. The protection of France, of the whole of the British Empire. We will sleep easily in our beds at night.
But surely there are other ways, I began. His hands tightened on mine.
There are none,
he insisted.
Do you know how long it took to arrange this treaty? It has been accomplished with great difficulty and in perfect secrecy. The rest of the world believes that the princess is in London simply to honor the English mountaineer and to go to the opera. They have no idea why she is here, and that is how it must remain. A social visit, an occasion for beautiful clothes and pretty music. But it is so much more.
His tone softened, and a pleading note crept in.
It is the very destiny of Europe. We want peace for our children, Fräulein.
I understand, I said slowly, but if you put out a statement saying your princess has fallen ill, his grip grew painful.
We have talked of this,
he said, his brows snapping together sharply.
The French would take it as a grave insult. They would believe that the Alpenwald does not negotiate in good faith. They would look at your German queen here in England and think that because we too have German ties, we have persuaded her to deal more generously with us. They would become suspicious, the French. They would refuse to sign the treaty because they would fear we strike deals behind their backs. They believe everyone is as cunning as they are.
He finished, his mouth tightening in disapproval. Stoker stepped forward.
Even if Veronica does this for you, it will not be legal, because the princess herself has not signed the treaty. I have thought of that,
the Chancellor replied happily. He dropped my hands and dove into another portfolio on the table. He drew out a lengthy piece of parchment, also embellished with the Alpenwalder crest.
This document gives Miss Speedwell the authority to sign the treaty on behalf of the Alpenwalder delegation as a proxy of the princess. Naturally, it must remain secret, he added. But if there were ever a need, it would stand up in court. Miss Speedwell would be acting with all of the authority of the Alpenwalder government.
I took the parchment and studied it, Stoker reading over my shoulder. It seems legal enough, I murmured. Do you not think so? He shrugged.
What I do not know about international diplomatic law would fill the libraries at Oxford,
he said. He passed the page back to the Chancellor.
The greater difficulty is not in Miss Speedwell performing this masquerade again. It is that this must end, sir. Surely you see that. She cannot continue the charade until you are ready to leave for home. Can she not?
The Chancellor asked, patting his lips. He stroked his moustaches into shape.
The signing of the treaty is tonight. Then there is only the opening of the exhibition at your club of Lady Explorers. After that, we return to our own country, and Miss Speedwell is free to resume her own life.
And if Her Serene Highness is still missing?
Stoker demanded.
What then?
The Chancellor held up a hand.
There is no need to fear this, he said. Our princess has always come back to us. She will do so again.
Silence held the room for a long moment. What must I do? I asked at last. The Chancellor, realizing the battle had been won, did not revel in the moment, but his eyes gleamed in satisfaction.
There is a simple ceremony to sign the treaty. A representative of Her Majesty's government to witness the affair, a French delegate, and yourself. These are the only three people who will be signatories to the document. It will be a very short meeting,
The treaty itself has already been agreed, and copies sent to each party. Everyone brings his own, and each of the three will be signed and countersigned. Once the signatures have been placed, that is all.
That is not all, the Baroness put in sharply. Have you forgot where the meeting is to take place?
I turned to the Chancellor, dread gripping my heart. Excellency, where are you sending me this evening?
It is nothing, child,
he said, raising his hands in protest.
An entertainment, a party.
A formal dinner,
the Baroness interjected. Excellency? I asked, narrowing my gaze. He looked from one of us to the other, then surrendered.
Very well. It is a formal dinner at Windsor Castle.
Chapter 19. I dared not look at Stoker. I dared not speak. With that perfect unspoken communication we sometimes shared, he intuited my disordered thoughts and gave voice to them.
And who will be in attendance at this dinner?
He asked smoothly.
The Queen? Members of the royal family?
Oh, no,
the Chancellor hastened to explain.
Her Majesty is at Osborne House, as is her custom this time of year, I am told.
And the rest of the royal family?
Stoker pressed. The Chancellor shrugged.
The Prince of Wales is also away, at his country house, somewhere in the east,
he said, waving a vague hand.
Sandringham House,
Stoker supplied,
in Norfolk.
Yes, that is it. I hear there is very fine shooting to be had,
the Chancellor said in a wistful tone.
He gathered there for the holidays with his children, and he also plays host to his sister, the Empress Frederick, and her daughters.
So there will be no member of the royal family at Windsor tonight,
Stoker said. The Chancellor's complexion turned ruddy again.
You are thinking it is an insult to my princess? To the honour of the Alpenwalders that there is no member of your royal family to receive her?
Nothing could be further from the truth,
Stoker assured him.
I merely find the choice of venue curious if the family are not meant to attend.
The Chancellor shrugged again.
It was the request of the Empress Frederick. She wishes to make it clear that although none of the British royalties will sign the treaty, it meets with their approval. A gracious gesture,
he added.
Indeed,
Stoker murmured. The tight band around my chest eased. I breathed a little easier. Do you know who will be in attendance? I managed.
A French delegation and assorted English representatives from within your government. From our side, naturally, I will escort the princess, and she will be attended by the Baroness. And by me.
Maximilian appeared in the doorway, looking like a man whose conscience had kept him awake. His eyes were a trifle puffed, and his moustaches drooped a little. The Chancellor looked pained.
As you are not yet formally affianced to Her Serene Highness, he began,
all the more reason to include him,
the Baroness put in.
It will demonstrate to the French that the treaty has the support of the entire Alpenwalder aristocracy, and not merely the princely family.
Maximilian smiled at the Baroness.
Just so.
The Chancellor huffed into his moustaches.
Very well. I will send word that there will be 2 additional members of our party.
He assured the Duke, as casually as if he were bringing an extra guest to tea. Stoker turned to me.
You cannot attend a formal dinner at the Queen's Castle and pretend to be foreign royalty.
The Baroness began to speak, but Stoker raised a hand.
I think Miss Speedwell and I will require a few minutes' privacy to discuss the matter.
He said, in a tone that brooked no argument. The Chancellor and Baroness withdrew, Maximilian trailing after them. He closed the door behind him, but it would not have surprised me to find him spying through a keyhole. I folded my arms over my chest and regarded Stoker. I managed it well enough last night, I reminded him.
Because no one was near you. You were surrounded by Alpenwalders and by me,
he pointed out.
You spoke to almost no one, and you had nothing to do but sit quietly and occasionally wave. A clockwork mannequin could have done as much.
Thank you, I said, my tone acid. It was actually a trifle more complicated than that.
Yes, I quite forgot. You also had to hold up a tiara. However did you manage it?
There is no call for sarcasm, I said.
What approach is called for?
He inquired.
Should I simply fling you over my shoulder and stalk out of here until you come to your senses?
Certainly not. Do not think I will play the Sabine, I warned him. I mean to do this. Besides, we needed a pretext to spend time with the Alpenwalders to investigate Alice's relationship with Gisela. We could hardly do better.
Than a semi-state occasion in a royal residence?
His tone softened.
You have not considered the complications. Veronica, it is a formal dinner at Windsor Castle. It will be full of British dignitaries and officials, people who could easily unmask you for the impostor you would be.
I am not acquainted with any members of the government, I protested.
Just because they are not known to you does not mean you are not known to them.
He thrust his hands through his hair, disordering it violently.
Veronica, be reasonable. You simply cannot swan through the gates of Windsor Castle as if you have a right to be there.
Don't I? I asked softly. I said nothing more, but I did not have to. He came forward and simply enfolded me in his arms.
I thought you wanted nothing from them.
I didn't, at least until I met Eddie, I corrected. Our latest foray into murder had seen us making the acquaintance of my half-brother, Prince Albert Victor of Wales, Eddie to his intimates. I had found myself growing quite fond of the young man during our short time together. He was silly and frustrating to an impossible degree, but I could not deny the attraction of spending time with those of my own blood. Growing up without family, I had never really placed much importance upon the connections of genetics. I had consoled myself with those whom I met upon my travels, whose tastes and values aligned with mine, with those who had proven themselves loyal and trustworthy out of true affection, not the obligations of blood. Eddie had been different. We were nothing alike, my half-brother and I, but I had been conscious of a deep pull to watch over him, a protectiveness I had seldom experienced before, and I wondered if it were unique to that young man, or if I would feel the same towards others of my family, towards the home I had never known, but to which I was tied by blood. For 800 years, my ancestors had lived and died in that castle. Would I feel any sort of recognition, any variety of belonging? This was perhaps the best opportunity I would have to find out.
Well, I suppose it is only a mercy that she will not be there,
Stoker said finally, resting his chin on the top of my head. He did not have to specify. I knew precisely whom he meant.
You can at least say hello to her portrait, I suppose.
Something like that.
You will be disappointed,
he warned me.
She looks very much like a turnip.
I stifled a laugh, and he drew back, his gaze intent.
I am deadly serious. She looks like a turnip in a black bonnet. Or I suppose, since they have state portraits there, you might see one where she is a turnip in a tiny crown.
I poked him firmly in the ribs. Behave. You forget I have seen her once before. I had watched her Golden Jubilee procession from a distance, scarcely able to see the small, rotund figure that had been smothered in ruffles and lace and tucked into a royal carriage. I looked up at him. You understand, do you not?
Better than you think. For all my bluster about my family, I still find myself running to them in spite of my best efforts.
He dropped a kiss to the top of my head.
I know you well enough to understand that you are going to do this with or without my blessing, so I may as well accept it.
Besides, I told him, we still do not know anything about who might have been aware of Gisela's connection to Alice, and who might, therefore, have wanted Alice dead. He slanted me an odd look.
Tell me that is why you want to do this, and I will accept the lie. But at least be honest with yourself. There is nothing about Alice Baker Green's death that is drawing you into this particular scheme. You have ghosts of your own to exorcise that have nothing to do with her.
It was an unkind observation, but it was not wrong, I reflected, as he went to open the door. As expected, Maximilian was hovering just outside, and he tumbled into the room, followed hard by the Baroness and the Chancellor. The Chancellor's expression was watchful, while the Baroness's was one of naked hope. Very well, I told them. I will do it, but the same terms as last night. I must be accompanied by Mr. Templeton Vane, and not merely as my guard, I stipulated. He must be acknowledged as a member of the delegation and seated at the formal supper. To my surprise, they agreed at once, and I felt a rush of emotion. I was going to a banquet at Windsor Castle, home of my grandmother, the Queen, and whether that emotion was fear or exhilaration, I could not tell. After a lengthy lesson on royal etiquette from the Baroness, Stoker and I were given a brief respite. Stoker complained of hunger and went to the room put aside for his use, with the packet of honeycomb he kept in his coat, whilst I rubbed my aching temples and picked up a discarded copy of the Weekly Portent that someone had stuffed beneath the sofa cushion. I could not imagine any member of the entourage taking an interest in such a periodical. It was a lurid little publication, even more outrageous than the Daily Harbinger. I wondered if one of the maids had been reading it and hidden it away, lest she be discovered shirking her duties. Exclusive interview with Princess's potential betrothed, Royal Man of Action, shouted the headline. I read the article with mounting disbelief. It was a lengthy piece on Duke Maximilian, describing the events of the previous night at the Opera House and detailing how his courage and perspicacity had saved Princess Gisela from harm when a bomb had exploded near her. The piece was stickily sentimental and flattering in the extreme, cataloguing his virtues as a man of the people, accomplished and yet never lacking the common touch. There was a formal photograph of him in uniform and two more in hunting garb and evening dress. He presented a perfect image of a man of the world, destined for greatness. He was quoted as saying that he was a devoted lover of his country, with no greater wish than to serve the Alpenwald by supporting the princess. He had many flattering things to say about England and the continued bonds between our countries, and the article ended with an encomium of praise so extreme I blushed for the author. The last lines were a direct appeal to the princess to accept the Duke's hand in marriage and give the Alpenwald the prince it so richly deserved. I nearly tossed the newspaper aside in disgust. The Duke had not flung himself on the perpetrator with complete disregard for his own personal safety, while shielding the princess from harm with his own muscular form. And he had certainly not apprehended the villain single-handedly before turning him over to the Metropolitan Police. Every other newspaper in the country reported the fact that the bomb thrower had not been identified, much less apprehended, and a dozen different descriptions had been circulated. Everything from a nutseller to a dowager duchess had allegedly hurled the explosive. Just then, my gaze went to the byline, and I caught my breath, blinking hard. J.J. Butterworth. I took the newspaper and hurried to find Stoker, running him to ground in the small bedchamber put at his disposal. He was reading a French novel and contentedly consuming the better part of the entire packet of honeycomb, happy as the proverbial clam. I thrust the newspaper into his sticky grasp. J.J. has lied to us, I proclaimed, in a state of high dudgeon. She indicated she was here in order to write a story about the princess, and yet she must have already seen Maximilian and interviewed him for this piece to run in today's newspaper. He considered this a moment.
More to the point, how did she happen to find him when the Chancellor and the Baroness did not even realize he was in London?
Read the last paragraph, I instructed. He skimmed it, his brows rising heavenwards as he did so.
Christ and his sleeping saints, do you realize what this means?
It means, I said grimly, that J.J. Butterworth has a very great deal to answer for. Chapter 20. We made our way to Julien's workrooms, appearing just as he was mournfully studying a bowl of curdled custard in the hands of a tearful assistant.
Archie, this is not a custard. This is a crime, he said gently. You must always handle a custard as you would a woman. Have you ever been with a woman?
The youth shook his head, his face flaming. Julien clapped a hand to his shoulder.
Let me tell you about my first love, Angelique. What a beauty she was. Martinique like me, and a sheen to her skin as if it were polished by the hand of God. She was plump, like a ripe piece of fruit, and when she undressed, her thigh, just above her stocking, it moved. What is the English word? Wibble?
Wobble? The young man guessed.
Wobble, yes. Her thigh would wobble. You must find such a woman, Archie. And when she undresses for you, watch her thigh. Worship it.
he instructed.
And when you return, you will know how a custard should move. It should look like the round and silken thigh of a woman.
He flapped a hand at the bowl.
Now, take this away and feed it to a sad cat in the alleyway. It pains me to see it.
The boy fled, custard bowl in hand, and Julien sighed.
My work, it is very taxing.
Clearly,
Stoker said with a grin. How is Angelique? Julien's expression turned mournful.
Married, with 9 children, and skinny now like the handle of a rake. It is enough to break the heart. What do you want, my friends?
We told him, and he dispatched an errand boy to find JJ. I expected her to prove elusive, but she strode in, her chin lifted defiantly. Julien made some tactful French noises and withdrew, no doubt sensing the interview would be an unpleasant one. He gestured towards a tray of guimauve as he went, and Stoker collected a handful as JJ seated herself with ill grace.
What? I have work to do, you know.
I held up the newspaper and she went pink to the tips of her ears.
I do not apologize for writing for the portent.
It is a rag, I told her.
It pays,
she said flatly. And that is my first byline on a front page.
One more story, the right story, and it will be enough to persuade the Harbinger to take me back.
What kind of story?
Stoker asked. She twitched a little, but said nothing.
Very well, I put in pleasantly. We have asked you nicely. Now we will be rather less than nice.
It is entirely apparent from this article that you must have written it before the explosive was thrown last night, didn't you? She shifted in her chair and set her mouth in a mulish line before bursting out.
Oh, very well, yes, I knew. I interviewed Maximilian early yesterday, before he went up to the suite.
How did you know he was here in London?
Stoker asked.
The other Alpenwalders were surprised by his appearance.
I saw him the night before. He used the service stairs to slip up to the royal suite. I was curious as to what was afoot, and he had eluded the hotel's security. I thought if an intruder was up to no good and I could foil some sort of attack, the princess might be grateful enough to grant me an interview. A nice exclusive I could sell to one of the larger newspapers. I crept up the stairs behind him, ready to catch him red-handed, as it were. Only he did not have to break into the suite.
Someone let him in, I guessed.
Durand, she said. He opened the door and called him by name. That is how I deduced his identity. I hid in one of the alcoves on the stairs, and after a very few minutes he returned. Only this time, he was not alone. He was with someone in a cloak.
She paused for effect, but Stoker merely shook his head.
I do not see the significance.
A cloak, she repeated. A maid's cloak. It was a plain, rather ugly thing that belonged to Yelena.
Why shouldn't Yelena go out? Presumably she has the occasional night off.
Because it was not Yelena in the cloak,
she said, her voice dropping to a thrilled whisper.
It was the princess.
How do you know? I put in.
Because it was miles too short, she replied. The princess has half a foot on her maid, and I could clearly see the hem of her frock hanging below the hem of the cloak. It was a dark blue velvet gown I had taken away to be sponged only that morning. It was edged with Mechlin lace. I was not likely to forget it.
Stoker did not bother to glance at me, but he heaved a sigh.
Veronica, I can feel the emanations from your person just now. Smug does not begin to describe them.
JJ looked from one of us to the other and back again. What is all that about?
Never mind,
Stoker and I chorused. He picked up the thread of the interrogation.
What next?
They walked around the corner and hailed a cab. I heard the address, so I followed in one of my own. I had the cabman drop me a street away and I kept to the shadows so they would not see me. They told the cabman to wait, and a short time later they got back in and went directly to St. Pancras Station. The Duke walked her in, and when he came out, he was alone and I was waiting for him. I invited him to share my cab, and he got in. No doubt thinking you were offering him something rather different than a mere ride in a cab, I mused. She smoothed her apron. Well, he might have misunderstood me at first, but I corrected his thinking quite quickly. I simply told him what I had witnessed and that I thought we could help one another. And on the strength of that, Maximilian gave you an interview? I asked. She shrugged again. Stoker looked at me.
Well, at least we know that Gisela did leave of her own accord. Whatever happened that night, it does not appear that Maximilian harmed her.
Max would never harm her, JJ said succinctly. He adores her. He has flirted outrageously with me and was prepared to avail himself of your services when he thought you were a prostitute, I told her. That is because he has very old-fashioned ideas about women, bless him, she said with some fondness. He thinks all women are either saints or whores. He does not know what to make of the rest of us. That is positively archaic, I muttered. He is an Alpenwalder aristocrat, she pointed out. They are not precisely known for their progressive thinking. The whole bloody country is mired in the Dark Ages. And you still wrote this, I said, brandishing the newspaper. To help him secure the post of consort. He is no worse than the rest of them, she said in a weary voice. I am most heartily tired of men. Stoker looked a little wounded. Not you, I soothed. Especially him, she corrected darkly. He ruined my story. He bristled.
What on earth did I do?
You threw yourself between the princess, she jabbed a finger in my direction, and the explosive, and after I had written a beautiful piece detailing Maximilian playing the hero. Anyone standing on that pavement knows what really happened. It was chaos, I told her, but your account was detailed to a suspicious degree. In order for you to know how things were meant to play out, you must have had advance knowledge. To her credit, she flushed again. I am sorry. I ought to have told you, but Maximilian swore me to secrecy and said there was no danger whatsoever. Maximilian. This time I did not bother to conceal my triumph. He knew. He arranged it, she said dully. It was only a large firework. It was meant to make a good deal of noise and smoke and nothing more.
Then what was the point of it? Stoker asked.
To let Max play the hero with Gisela, JJ explained. She has been dragging her feet over accepting his proposal and he is growing desperate. It was put to him that if she felt vulnerable, it might nudge her towards marriage, a situation where she was threatened, even if only for a moment, and he acted decisively and courageously, might be just enough to tip her into his arms.
Suggested?
Stoker pounced upon the word.
By whom?
By an unlovely gentleman to whom he owes money. Maximilian is a bit of a gambler. He likes betting on horse races, dog races, turtle races.
Turtle races?
Stoker asked.
How the bloody hell does one race a turtle?
Slowly, she said, with a ghost of her old smile. He went to Deauville after a quarrel with Gisela and found himself overextended. The fellow to whom he owes the money has rather nasty schemes for getting his debts repaid. The French lads in his employ are not above using a few persuasions, a club applied to a kneecap, an explosive tossed through a window, whatever the situation requires. One of them threw the squib last night at a signal from Max. He blended into the crowd and was back in France on the first Channel steamer. You can despise him all you like, but I can assure you the alternative would have been worse. The Duke has fallen in with a particularly nasty crowd who will not take it well if he fails to pay his debts of honour. She paused, drawing in a breath. See here, I know what I did was very wrong, but no harm was actually done. I have spent my entire life taking risks like that. I haven't had any other way to get ahead. And I have my first front page byline out of it, so if you are expecting an apology, I am afraid you will be sitting in the anteroom of hell before you hear one out of me. She lifted her chin, and in spite of her defiance, I was rather glad to see something of her old spirit in evidence. I did not like a defeated JJ.
What about the chocolate box?
Stoker asked.
There was a threat left inside a box of rose and violet creams on the princess's dressing table.
Another suggestion from Max's unsavory companion from Deauville. He wanted to put Gisela on edge a bit, so the bomb would feel even more frightening when it went off. Make her feel like she was surrounded by enemies, that sort of thing. That is diabolical, I said. How on earth can she possibly marry such a man? JJ waved a dismissive hand. He is no worse than most and better than many. The Duke is treading water just now, you know. He owes a great deal of money and he is frightened. I think we all know how stupid frightened people can be. We all fell silent for a moment, and then Stoker spoke.
When Maximilian and Gisela stopped on the way to the station, where did they go?
JJ studied her nails. I do not think I should say. What? I asked, resisting the urge to shake her. JJ shook her head and smiled. I have told you quite enough and got nothing in return. Now, if you want anything else, you will have to make it worth my while. Stoker, your note case, I said quickly. How much have you got? I do not want money, she protested, clearly offended. I want something far more valuable than that. She sat back with an air of triumph.
What on earth could we have that is more valuable than banknotes?
Stoker asked. Her smile was rapacious. It is very simple, and will cost you absolutely nothing. I simply want to go to the dinner at Windsor Castle, as the attendant of Her Serene Highness, the Princess Gisela of the Alpenwald. A long moment of horrified silence followed her pronouncement. Stoker spoke first.
Out of the question.
How do you even know about the dinner? I asked. It is all the Alpenwalders talk about, she said. They are very excited. Apparently it is one of the grandest things to happen to them since the Holy Roman Emperor came to tea in 1225. No one in Europe was drinking tea in 1225, I informed her acidly. She gave a shrug. Details. Now, may I come? Absolutely not, I told her, relishing the moment. She sat back and folded her arms over her chest. Make it happen, or I will publish a story in tomorrow's newspaper about my time in the Sudbury Hotel working as a chambermaid, where I uncovered the fact that an English woman of dubious reputation has been masquerading as a missing princess, she said coolly.
You would not dare,
Stoker began, but his tone was doubtful. She absolutely would dare. My reputation is not dubious, I protested. It is not exactly Lily White, she countered. And of course I will make certain to mention your inamorato, the black sheep of a distinguished aristocratic family, and naturally, if his name is mentioned, it will revive all those nasty stories about his divorce, she added. You absolute! The word I used was not relevant to this narrative, but it was entirely appropriate, causing Stoker to blush furiously. Sticks and stones, JJ said calmly. Do we have a bargain? I will tell you everything I know about the princess's departure, and I will promise not to write about your origins for publication if you take me with you to Windsor. Why? I asked. I find it highly suspicious that you would willingly relinquish as explosive a story as that, simply for the chance to see Windsor Castle. It is open to the public, you know. You could visit some Sunday with a nice group of tourists. Take a hamper for a picnic luncheon. She bared her teeth in what a foolish person might have thought was a smile. I have bigger fish to fry, my dear. The scandalous peccadilloes of minor royalty are nothing compared to the story I want to write. Something that will establish once and for all that I ought to be taken seriously by the editors.
Something political,
Stoker guessed. Full marks to Templeton Vane, she said. You are a demon in a petticoat, I told her. How can we be certain you will keep your bargain? She had the nerve to look offended. I have never broken my word to you, and I do not intend to begin now. I thought we were friends, Veronica. Or, if not friends, at least that we understood one another. In spite of myself, I felt my rage ebbing. The trouble was, I did understand her. The challenges of being an intelligent woman working in a world limited by the whims of narrow-minded and unimaginative men were legion. JJ had struggled for years to secure respect for herself as an investigative journalist, one who wrote important stories about the people shaping events. She longed to influence discourse, to raise topics worthy of discussion, of international importance. Her ambitions were limitless, but her scope was small. She was, very, very occasionally, permitted to write a piece that touched upon something of real merit, but far more often she was relegated to writing knitting patterns or describing teething remedies for children. It was an endless trial for her, and while I deplored her methods, I understood her motivation. Very well, I said. Stoker spluttered, but I stood my ground. She has us over the proverbial barrel, I reminded him. The Daily Harbinger is no friend to you. I will not have the business of your divorce raked up again. The mud has only just dried. He curled a lip in disgust, and JJ had the grace to look a little embarrassed. But she did not back down, and I put out my hand. Very well. If the Chancellor does not object, you may come as my maid, but you will conduct yourself at all times like a proper servant, I warned her. It is absolutely essential that you make no trouble. I will not bother to explain the consequences to you if you fail me tonight, I added in a low voice. I think your own imagination will suffice. She blanched a little, but rallied. I will not fail, she promised. See that you don't. Stoker and I rose to leave, but just as we reached the door, he turned back, almost as an afterthought.
When Maximilian and Gisela stopped on the way to St. Pancras, where did they go?
JJ helped herself to a handful of sugared almonds, crunching them soundly before replying. It is rather odd, I thought. They went to that club of yours, Veronica, the Curiosity Club. How long did they stay? I asked. She munched another almond, shrugging. 10 minutes? I cannot imagine what they wanted there, but Gisela left with a parcel about so big, she added, holding her hands a foot and a half apart.
What sort of parcel?
Stoker inquired. Something a little unwieldy. Max carried it into St. Pancras for her, but when he came back out, it was gone. Gisela must have taken it with her, wherever she went.